folks, if we can reconvene, Dr. Peter McCormick got nabbed by Global, so we might have been delayed a bit. So if there's any breaks and questions, then I'll know that that wasn't an inconvenience for you. So before I ask him to take the podium and before you think about some of the questions you might have entertained at your table, I would just like to mention that next week's topic is called A More Democratic Alberta, How Do We Get There? And the speaker is Dr. Harold Jansen, an associate professor of political science at the University of Lethbridge. So this is sort of a political month, so Dr. Harold Jansen will be with us next week. But there have been a lot of, there's certainly a lot of discussion at our table, but of course we had our guest at ours. But I'm sure you've got a number of questions, and I will call upon some of the folks here maybe to repeat some questions that we had the privilege of entertaining at our table. But who can I call upon first?
Okay, I'll go home then.
Oh, no, you can't go home.
Thanks for coming out, Peter. My question is, my name is Knut Peterson, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Peter, how easy or how hard would it be for the new president of the United States to change things around a lot since the American economy depends so heavily on war and weaponry, manufacturing? How difficult would it be to change things around in a hurry?
Well, yeah, American politics is like steering a supertanker. I mean, it's not that the person at the wheel can't have some control. It's that you're not going to turn the sucker on a dime no matter what you do. It's going to take a long time to have much effect. Anybody who comes to the White House, anybody who comes to a position of authority in U.S. politics is going to face a massive amount of inertia that's hard to change and a lot of commitments that can't easily be taken back. So you've got to look for a president can have symbolic impact up front. They always try to do that to give the feeling of change early, but it's late in their first term or into their second term that you actually see any real sign of change. There's a lot of realities to being the global superpower that really constrain what any president can do in office. So some of the more optimistic hopes about how if we only got George Bush and the Republicans out of the White House, wouldn't it be a better world? Well, bluntly, no, not right away. There might be progress toward a better world, but it would be slow.
I would like to ask a question. My husband and I recently returned from a trip to the United Arab Emirates, and I was absolutely amazed on TV, just the coverage that this election and the primaries are getting worldwide. And at our table, some folks have just returned from Australia, and they too were quite impressed or surprised at the kind of worldwide attention. And perhaps it's just because I haven't watched CNN in Abu Dhabi before, but it was interesting because people there are watching with the greatest of interest. And is part of this just the phenomenon of American politics, and I haven't been away during this time? Is it because of the war and we're looking for something better in the United States? But what's your feeling about the worldwide attention?
Yeah, but then you take away two-thirds of my answer. Okay, no. Obviously, one factor is that the last 8 to 10 years in the world has not been as much fun as the 8 to 10 years before it. It's been a very difficult time, and the United States has played a very controversial part in making it quite a different world with quite a different feel to it. And so for a lot of people, much more so outside the U.S. than inside, the end of the Bush era is something to be welcomed and celebrated, and what they're looking at is a peek at what's going to happen next. So the more you disliked the Bush era, the more you disliked the face that America increasingly took on through the Bush years, the more you look forward to the end of it, and you want some thought of what lies beyond it. The second factor would always be, it's just one heck of a good show. I mean, if it wasn't happening in real life, you'd have to make a TV show out of it. Golly, they did. I mean, those of you who followed The West Wing, that fabulous TV series, they ended it with a campaign for the presidential nomination for one of the political parties. And the candidate, one of the characters in it was Jimmy Smits, playing this charismatic dynamic Hispanic, challenging the initial front runner. The writers for West Wing never made any secret of it. They modeled Jimmy Smith's character in that on this guy called Barack Obama, who had this incredible impact on the Democratic National Convention a couple of months earlier. So they picked up on whole speeches from Barack Obama and just modified them a bit to give them to their character. So in a funny way, we've already seen this on American television, except they didn't have the nerve to make the other person, the initial favorite, a woman. And if they had, they'd have done it perfectly. They'd all be saying, oh, I've seen it before. You know. that's a second feature. A third feature is, as we all know perfectly well, we in Canada more than most because we're right next door, the President of the United States is not just the President of the United States. The President of the United States is the most powerful person on the planet, the person whose decisions, choices, and priorities are going to impact our lives right away and for years to come. So even if you can't have any say about it, and even if they won't listen to you ever, still watching as that person is chosen and trying to get a feeling for how that power is going to be used over the next 4 to 8 years, that's well worth doing anyway.
Thank you, Peter. Howard?
Howard Forsyth, you mentioned 25 years of politics. I tell the people at Diamond Willow Lodge in McGrath that I've had 100 years of close observation because I was in Provo in January 32, and in November in the Y News, I wrote a byline story on the front page about the disappearance of the Hoover. Now, here's my question, and you didn't quite touch on it. Here's a question. You gave all kinds of...
Howard, back up just a bit from the mic. It's echoing. Thank you.
You gave all kinds of terrific concepts of what's going on. The most dramatic election in the history of democracy anywhere in the world. And it is sliding over the reputation of the United States as the greatest country in the world, and now nearly everybody believes that it isn't. What about that? Doesn't this election either salvage or destroy fully the notion, even for the Americans, that they lead in everything and God's on their side?
Oh, no, nothing could dent that. I mean, that the Americans know that. The greatest... I avoid superlatives because my colleagues then pin me to the wall on them for ages to come. So it is certainly one of the most exciting elections. That's my cowardly, retranslation of it. Americans are, by and large, Americans are not as aware of the rest as the rest of the world and don't care as much about the rest of the world and what they think about American democracy. Americans are proud of what they've got operating, period. I don't think anything's going to dent that. I do think there is a reasonable chance, we can play with percentages forever, there's a reasonable chance that McCain will become the next president of the U.S. and the Republicans will still be in office and all this nice Hillary, Obama stuff we're talking about will be a historical might have been that academics will get to talk about for years and everyone else will just vaguely remember. That's entirely a possibility. If it happens, the Americans will still celebrate their wonderful system. They're so focused on themselves, they are so apathetic, uninformed, and indifferent about anything going on outside their country. To the extent they are aware how the rest of the world has been annoyed with them ever since they began reacting to 9/11, it's basically, in your eye to the rest of the world. It just proves the rest of the world isn't paying attention to what really matters. And I think that's the center of gravity of American politics. I don't think you're going to dent it. Whoever wins, whoever loses, whatever the result is, whether it's a clean outcome, whether it's a dirty outcome with contested things all over the place, I mean, it's not going to matter to them. They celebrate America, they celebrate the United States, freedom isn't free, all that stuff. That's very deep-rooted in the United States. I don't think you're going to dent it. It's not going to be changed by this election. America will continue thinking that America is the world, and the rest can look over the fence and enjoy.
The rest of the world has lost the glamour, haven't they?
Oh, the rest of the world has lost. To the rest of the world, the United States has lost a lot of its glamour. Americans never notice that much anyway. I mean, Americans are not good at noticing what anybody else in the world thinks about them. They haven't been for ages. And that continues today. It will continue in the future. To some extent, they get more insular when they notice people are insulting them. So it's more a self-reinforcing thing rather than a self-correcting thing.
Austin Fennell, I have a first of all, a personal question. Whether the political scientist enjoys the symbol of being a prophet?
only if people forget or if you're right.
Okay, I would like you to address the question about the American president having a collection of symbols around him or her. And does that symbol get crushed once in a while by and bring about the downfall of a president, even if they're still passing regulations and so on?
First of all, symbolism is an important aspect of politics, and no effective leader can ever leave the symbolism out of it. It's a resource that you use that reinforces what goes, the power that goes along with choices. And the more powerful your office, the more important the symbols are. And so the U.S. presidency is now the single most important office on the planet. The symbolism that goes on, all the little symbols, the Rose Garden stuff, the crest behind, all the little symbolism aspects they pick up on are so deeply ingrained, you probably couldn't do a story about the president without using at least two or three of them. Over time, can that be eroded? Definitely. I mean, presidents have let the people down over. When Bill Clinton was leaving office, he was the great disappointment. He was only a fraction of what he was expected to be. He squandered large chunks of his potential. So did he diminish the presidency? To some extent, he did. Has George Bush diminished it in the eyes of at least half the Americans? He definitely has. So the office has taken some hits. It's big enough that the office can stand the hits. And the Americans have this lovely rule of two and out. So you can't run for president a third time anyway. So the fact that you used up your political capital doesn't hurt the office at all. One of the things that always astonishes me, and here it goes again in the United States, George Bush, who's he? He's vanished. Obama and Hillary are there all the time. Even McCain gets more. Bush now gets attention for meeting with McCain. Go figure, right? It's been a long time since that's been true. It's amazing how, it's like the old legal formula I've always loved. The king is dead, long live the king. The story moves on, and that's the nature of the monarchy. The king is dead, long live the king. Well, in this case, the king isn't actually dead yet, but we're still focusing more on the would-be future kings already, and it just vanishes off the stage. Happens to every president. They all declare they're going to set things up so they won't go through this eclipse like earlier presidents did. Nope, you just can't fight it. The spotlight has moved on. And, depressing thought, Bush would have to declare war on somebody to get that attention back. Let's hope he's not listening and didn't hear that.
I don't see someone else up here, so I have another question. And we talked a little bit at our table about running mates, and I've heard it said that the vice president is really That's it. Thank you very much. It just wasn't going to come. And we had a little discussion about that. Would you like to just embellish the audience about our little table talk?
Okay, in the notes that people pointed out I never follow, I did say a bit about this. Given that if you're a Democrat, given the fact that you have an embarrassment of riches, you have your choice of two grand historic firsts to go with, of course you've got to stop and think, why do I have to choose? Why can't I have my cake and eat it too? And so the dream ticket for a lot of Democrats is one of them first, the other one as vice president. Forget for the moment the fact that Clintons tried to float that for their own immediate advantage in the leadership race and promptly got hammered for it. Obama, you can almost feel the Obama camp looking for the, mad as heck, but looking for the right way to dish this whole debate. And the beautiful one Obama found was, how often does the person who's running first, running second, offer the person who's running first the second place on the ticket? That really takes some nerve. And the minute he said that, it was gone. The Clintons have not mentioned it again since. But I think it's very unlikely to happen simply because this contest is so important. And also, they're both young enough. We're looking at a possible two-term president. So whichever one you... getting tucked into their wake is not the way you want to go. The better route, if you're either one, so now it doesn't matter, your candidate A and candidate B is going to win the nomination. Whichever one you are, your best hope is to hope they lose, and you can run again for the nomination next time and win it. That's the only way you get a shot in 4 years. If you become their vice presidential candidate, you take the hit along with them. You're tainted as well. And you can always argue, if I'd been number one, it would have gone better. That's a weak argument. You're better to sit it out all together, let them bounce off McCain and let McCain win. I think the one thing we can be absolutely sure of, McCain is not going to run again for a second term as president. I could be, okay, don't write that one down. But I think that one's fairly safe. Therefore, you're only looking at one term before you get another shot at it. That's not very long. But if you contribute to the dream ticket and the other one actually wins, then you get 8 years as vice president. Wow, isn't that great? And by then, you're no longer new or exciting or interesting. If you're Hillary, you're about the age that McCain was. It's gone. So, no, I don't think either one would agree to give you the dream ticket. The loser will step back and see what happens to the winner. I don't think they'll pick each other as running mates. Now, therefore, they get back into the endless calculations. They will try to find somebody within the Democratic Party who is not like them. You know, if you're Northern, you want someone Southern. If you're Eastern, you want someone Western. If you're this, you want someone that. You've got to balance the ticket is the endless game of American politics. As for how important the vice presidential candidate is, being vice president is often a decent stepping stone to being the presidential candidate next time around. If your time frame is long enough, maybe that's worth thinking about. Being vice president, presidents don't necessarily live forever. It just feels that way. So, there's always the chance. That's why when McCain picks his vice presidential candidate, people are really going to be paying attention. Even a 71-year-old picks who's going to replace him if anything happens to his health, you take that one more seriously. But for the Democrats, it's mostly balance the ticket and somebody with long-term aspirations, that's who would find it attractive. And I don't think either one would agree to run with the person they're running against, partly because the calculations are wrong, partly because they're getting pretty mad at each other. They're trying hard not to let it show through because if the Democrats want a really good shot at McCain, you've got to come through this fiercely contested nomination with everybody staying friendly and happy. If somebody walks away, slams the door, and curses as they walk out, there's your dream gone. You just lost one chunk of your constituency, and McCain is the only person partying over that one. So you got to keep it friendly. But do they like each other? Absolutely not. There's no goodwill coming out of this one between those two people. Now, that doesn't always mean you can't run together, but since the calculations aren't pushing them together, I just think it's not going to happen.
Can you give us your name, please?
Gary Stauffer. Do you think there is any hope of reform for their primary system? And a second question, give us your take on the Canada-U.S. relations change we might expect, depending on who might win.
Okay. First of all, the weird thing, glad you asked the question. The Democrats actually have reformed their primary system. This is the reformed primary system you're watching. The big difference between the messy old one and the nice shiny new one is the messy old one used to say if you got the more votes than any other candidate in a state as a would-be nominee, you got every single delegate vote in the nominating meeting that was coming up in the summer. The new rule is you break it down by percentage. If you won with 55%, you get 55% of the delegates. If the person you beat got 40%, they get 40% of the delegates. Now, the obvious question, and no one seems to be asking, it's obvious to me, how much of a difference is this actually making? So in order to prepare for this talk today, I sat down out of curiosity and said, I'm going to go through all the presidential primaries for the Democrats, and I'm going to see what would have happened if they'd been winner-take-all instead of the new reformed method, which is divide proportionately. And, okay, basically right now Obama has a lead over Clinton of about 150. No one can agree if it's 135 or 157 or whatever. It's around 150 is the lead he's got over Clinton. If you go through every primary result so far, and you give it to the person who won the popular vote, all the delegates from that state, then you do dramatically change the outcome. Now Hillary has a lead over Obama, and her lead is 100 delegates. It's still neck and neck. This contest would still be going down to the wire. It would still be going right into the convention unsettled, even if you had a winner-take-all system in place. That's the weird thing. It hasn't made any difference. As to, will they do away? The Americans love it. I mean, this is fun in spades. The parties love it. To the Democrats, this is we are exciting. We are focusing attention. We are drawing people out in the primary voting. Take that with a grain of salt, by the way, right? There's enormous turnout in primary voting. At the moment, we have not yet passed the 7 million people have voted point for the U.S. presidential nominee choices for the Democrats. They're under 7 million. The losing person who runs for president in November will get something over 65 million votes. The loser will get that many. The winner will be around 70 million or higher. So how many people vote in primaries? It's ridiculously low. So they can trumpet this massive turnout, three times as many as last time. Yeah, we're up from 1% to 3%. Woo, I'm thrilled. The turnout isn't much. But if you're a Democrat, you're number one, the turnout is up. Up is always better than down. Number two, the media coverage is wonderful. What Republican Party, you know? Only the Democrats are getting they get the top seven news stories night after night. That's worth millions of dollars. And you know, thirdly, if you can keep the show going, you generate that magic word from politics, momentum, you know? So for all those reasons, they will not do away with it. They love it. It's functional for the parties. And they think it's a hallmark, a democratic hallmark of their system that they really value. The alternative is the so-called smoke-filled rooms, you know, where the party brokers go and make up, cook up their dirty little private deals, and then they present you with the outcome, and you take it or leave it. They like this one way better.
What about the second part of that question about Canadians? Oh.
Well, the impact on Canada. Okay, somebody, we don't know who, maybe Ian Brody, but since he leaked a story against Clinton and it came out against Obama, I think that takes him completely off the hook. Whoever leaked the Obama story, it wasn't Brody. He was leaking the other one that no one paid any attention to. So, okay, forget Ian Brody. Somebody leaked this interaction between an Obama representative and the Canadian government, and that made us visible during an election campaign in the U.S. Who could have figured? You know, most years we'd have to nuke them to get that kind of attention. But this time around, we managed to get that attention for something purely internal. Highly unfortunate. If the Democrats win, and like I say, 60-40 at best, but if the Democrats win, then whoever has been elected for the Democrats has got to demonstrate that whatever the leak was, it wasn't them, because they're going to be every bit as tough against Canada as the Ohio campaign suggested they would be. So they're going to have to kick us around the block for a while. They're going to have to be mean, you know. When they talk about, there's a lot of people in this room who are less than enthusiastic about free trade. You do not want what the Americans have in mind from renegotiating it, though, you know. And you do not want the attitude with which they'll be renegotiating it. They're not talking about dealing with your concerns. They're talking about dealing with their concerns. And their concerns have to make whatever the deal is, it's going to be worse for us and better for them when they're done. The weird thing is, it isn't even us they're mad at, it's the Mexicans. But they said it in Ohio, and we got caught in the fallout through somebody's clumsiness. That's going to hurt us. In the long run, how much will it hurt us? To be really crass, not much. They need the oil. So in the end, we'll all be friends. But along the road, we may have to take a few elbows here and there.
Bob, you had a question.
Bob Anderson. Peter, tell us a little bit about how the people in the smoke-filled room, what do they base their decisions? What are the things that may affect them?
Okay. The reference to the smoke-filled room is the fact that if you get a primary competition that doesn't generate a clear winner, then the decision winds up being made by what they call superdelegates, what we call ex officio delegates. That is, people who are delegates with full voting rights at the convention, not because they've been elected to represent somebody, but by virtue of some office they hold, like being a U.S. senator or, you know, some elected position like that. And there's a fair swatch of them that go into the Democratic convention. By definition, they go in uncommitted and unpledged. They're there by virtue of who they are. They don't need to do anything else to get selected, and therefore they exercise their own judgment. Now, if you get a real swing going in the elected delegates, they don't matter. Like, you know, how will the Republican equivalent of superdelegates vote when they get their convention? Who cares? You know, it's over, it's done, McCain is the candidate. They can do whatever they want. But in the case of the Democratic one, it is going to be so close still going into the convention at the end of August that it's the superdelegates who get to pick the presidential nominee, just as if there were no elected delegates at all. Democrats hate that. This is not the best outcome. This is the worst outcome. Going into it, a lot of factors enter into it. First of all, who do you owe favors to? Because one of your favors is how you cast your vote in that situation. That's where the Clintons have an enormous advantage over Obama. A lot more people owe Bill Clinton favors. Some owe Hillary Clinton favors. Smaller number, but non-zero. A lot more of those two added together than owe Obama favors. So one is the backward-looking thing. Who do I owe favors to? Hillary's so far ahead in that, it's not even funny. The second one is the what's in the future? What does this candidate mean for us and for the party? And right now, that's who can beat McCain is going to be the consideration for that one. You know, that's what they're going to have to be thinking about. What's best for the party is winning. Who's got a chance of winning? And the third consideration they're going to have is what's going to look better in the general public. I mean, if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination because of the backroom deals, if you're a Democrat, do you really want that going into the next campaign? I mean, the Clinton camp is arguing they should exercise independent judgment. Nudge, nudge, wink, but don't worry about how the majority voted. The Obama camp is arguing the people should speak. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, go along with the delegates. And we're a whole 100 delegates ahead out of 3,000, you know. So go along with that. We'll see how it comes out. But for the Democrats, it's bad to have the superdelegates picking. And since they know it's bad, they may try to become invisible by going along with the way the elected delegates went.
Well, if there are no more questions, I just would like us to thank Dr. Peter McCormick, always the teacher. Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much.